Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
I don't know if you've thought this before. I don't know if you've read studies on this before. There has been work on this done. But the idea that attractive people get more advantages, attractive people do better in life, attractive people make more money. There are studies that show all of those things are true. Now, attractive is a subjective term, so it's a little difficult. But what if we apply this to school? Do you think that there is a chance that attractive students get better grades? Well, we don't really have to wonder so much now. There is a new study that has been done. It's from Sweden. It's from Lund University in Sweden. The person who did the study, his name is Adrian Mayhick. He joins us now. Thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So this is as I said off the top, this is a fascinating study because attractiveness is a subjective idea. Nonetheless, there are some universal or more universal views of what is attractive. When you studied whether attractive students get better grades, what did you find?
Yeah, so basically what we saw that was before the pandemic, when teachers could see the faces of the students or professors in this case, because we're at university, then the attractive students, both the males and the females, got better grades.
And I think a lot of people might have thought, oh, that might be true. But I don't know that they would have expected that if you put science to it, they would have found that that was actually the case. So how do you do this? This is, again, there's subjectivity in this. So how do you study? First of all, how do you determine who is attractive? That's a tricky one to start with.
Yeah, basically, you take pictures of the people that you want to study. Of course, it can be, in this case, students. But for instance, if you would have studied, do workers get higher wages or something, if they're attractive, well, then you would just take the pictures of the workers. So in this case, we had pictures of the students and we let the jury rate their attractiveness from a 1 to 10 scale.
Okay, so there is no objective standard to this. This is simply putting it in front of a bunch of people and saying, tell us who's good looking and who isn't as good looking.
Exactly, and that's what they do in this literature. So there's no kind of novelty to this. But this is the standard way of doing this in this research, basically.
Okay, and once you had established that baseline, did you, before you even got into what they did during the COVID period, did you look at what their grades were like going into COVID to see if attractive people had higher marks?
Yeah, exactly. And that was the case. You know, the attractive people, the attractive students had higher marks before the pandemic. And then during the pandemic, something happened. And that's what was so interesting about this study, actually.
Were the higher marks only in the courses like languages or arts, things where there is a lot more subjectivity? Because it couldn't possibly have translated into the sciences where there is a right or a wrong, is there?
Exactly. That's right. It was only in these kind of more in the subjects where there is no really right or wrong, right? Whereas in maths and physics, we didn't see this effect at all.
Okay. All right. So it's not like, I don't know how you would have done that there. I mean, as I say, there's a right or there's a wrong. So what was the difference? I mean, are we talking a percentage or two, or are we talking something significant that the attractive people benefited?
I mean, it's kind of difficult to sort of quantify this, but yeah. So we're talking maybe, yeah, say 5 to 10% better. And
that's also a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And imagine this in terms of wages, you know, 5 to 10% higher wage over a lifetime, or 40 years of working.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not small potatoes, actually. And
not at all.
Yeah.
And I don't know, Adrian, what the situation is like. I'm not as familiar with Sweden's education system. I don't know how challenging it is to get into universities there out of high school. But here, 5 to 10% in certain courses might mean the difference between a program you really want and a program you don't want.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, and because we have university grades here, I mean, 5 to 10% could be the difference between your dream job and your job that you kind of don't really want. So it is kind of as implications for not just for your grades, but also for your future career.
Did you talk after doing this study and finding this out? Did you talk at all to professors to see if they thought that this was happening or if they were completely oblivious?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the most people kind of assume that this is correct, or it makes kind of intuitive sense. But I guess that many people were also a bit, you know, kind of angry that this research had been published, because they didn't want to be, treated as they were kind of discriminating against people. Mm-hmm. And this was a kind of slightly controversial even among some professors, actually, that they didn't like this result, right? That we kind of painted this this picture that they were actually discriminating in favor of beautiful students.
Although, you know, it's funny because you use the word, and I'm sure it's the correct word in this when you say discriminating. I'm sure that's the right word. Yet I'm not sure this isn't simply human nature. And I wonder if any professor went out of their way, his or her way, to say, oh, that person's beautiful, I've got to help them along. I just wonder if this is just who we are and we like things that look nice.
Exactly. So we kind of associate good-looking people with other characteristics, right, as well. We just like being surrounded by beautiful people. And there's also kind of interesting research in psychology that actually shows that your brain activity increases when you see a beautiful person. So that would have to hold for teachers and their students as well, even though it's, you know, slightly controversial issue, obviously, because the age difference is usually quite substantial.
That too. Is there any, but even when you do this, and I think this is a fantastic study because it's so fascinating, the downside to a study like this is, what do you do with this now that you know? Because is there really any way? Because to fix this, you would have to have professors or teachers or whomever say, you're kind of not very good looking, so I got to be careful I don't grade you too harshly. Like, it's really difficult to do anything with this.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, and this is kind of human nature, as you said, right? So it's kind of difficult to see what can we do, right? But for instance, in the kind of university setting, then maybe you could have anonymous exams to a greater extent, for instance, and there are similar kind of ways of dealing with this. But generally, in certain environments, it's very difficult actually to do something about this.
And well, yeah, for sure it is. And the other part is, let's say that you get a low grade, not you, you're a bright student who's finishing your PhD, but let's say someone gets a lower grade. It's a really awkward thing to walk into a professor and go, I know why you gave me a low grade. It's because I'm really ugly. I mean, that's a really tough thing
and
to
that's
argue.
Nothing to say. Yeah, of course. And that's also a bit, bit intimidating for the professor as well as for the students, I would say.
Absolutely it is. This is, as I say, this is a really, by the way, I should add, before we go, was there any difference? You said at the top, male and female students. Maybe I'm being too old school here, but was there a difference when it was a male professor and an attractive female, by and large? I know, you know, that we may have gay professors or whatever, but was it more pronounced when it was a male professor and a good-looking female student, or vice versa, a female professor and a good-looking male student?
Yeah, I mean, most of the professors are male here, right? So there was a bigger effect, sort of male professor and female student. However, also some of the female professors gave the beautiful females a better grade. So kind of this female beauty premium holds both when the professor is male and also when the professor is female. So yeah,
I guess it's good. It's good to be a good-looking woman, is it?
Exactly.
I guess that's the moral.
That is quite good.
Adrian Mayhick from Lund University in Sweden. Very much appreciate you doing this today. Thank you so much. This was a fascinating study. Thanks for talking about it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Ryan Reynolds wanting to buy the Ottawa Senators. The actor, Deadpool actor, was at the Senators game last night. He has expressed, he was on the Tonight Show, saying he wants to buy the Ottawa Senators, or at least be involved in buying the Ottawa Senators. However, even he says, yeah, I'm going to have to find someone to help me out here. It's a lot of money. Well, for us, it would have stayed there until a couple days ago when another name started popping into the discussion. The Globe and Mail today said that Michael Andlauer, owner of the Hamilton Bulldogs, is now the front runner to be the new owner, to be able to buy the Ottawa Senators. The first person who had mentioned Michael Andlauer's name, at least as far as I saw. The guy who introduced this topic to the public, his name is Bruce Garriock. He writes for the Hamilton, or for the Ottawa Sun, joins us now. Bruce, thanks for doing this today. Really appreciate it. Bruce, you there?
Yep.
There we go. Thanks for doing this, Bruce. Really appreciate it.
Nice to talk to you.
So does anybody in Ottawa, I know that there was a lot of excitement last night when Ryan Reynolds was at the game. Does anybody in Ottawa particularly care who owns the Senators as long as they keep them there?
Well, I think so in some way, shape, or form. I think that, you know, people here want a good owner. Obviously, you know, Eugene Melnyk leaves behind a very complicated legacy here. But he did save the team from bankruptcy in 2003 when nobody else wanted to keep this team in Ottawa. And his family, you know, plans to hold on to a legacy piece. Scott, it's going to be interesting. I mean, this is as much a real estate deal as it is a deal for the hockey team. And there's a very valuable piece of land downtown, a LeBreton Flats. It's 10 minutes from downtown. When the O train here works, it will stop right at LeBreton Flats, and it will be perfect. It'll be a perfect location for the hockey team. That land has to be developed. The rink that the New York Islanders just built was $1 billion. You've got to think that this rink is going to cost $1 billion to build downtown. The price of the hockey team, Sportico had it at $650 million. I think the Senators feel that the value of their franchise will be much higher than that, and I think that there are going to be several interested parties, and I think that Michael Andlauer is fairly obvious because he owns 20% of the Montreal Canadiens. He has no say. He's already in the club and being a part owner. To me, he just makes a lot of sense.
I laughed, by the way, when you mentioned that. We've got an LRT project going on here. So when you talk about the LRT working sometimes, that was the explanation for that.
Not follow Ottawa's model.
Good suggestion. It is a really interesting thing when you say that this is a real estate play because, and I think a lot of people here, I don't think I'm breaking news to a lot of people even listening. You're very familiar with this. The LeBreton Flats thing has been going on for a long, long time. So,
2016.
Yeah, so what happens, it looks like things are moving in a much more positive way now, at least from the outside it looks that way. What happens if this doesn't happen? I mean, assuming that it does, the team is in Ottawa then for in perpetuity, everyone's happy, it's a great location. What if that doesn't happen?
You know, I haven't really thought of that because I just feel like this time it's actually going to happen. I think what has to happen is when the new owner buys a team, and I think that's why there's a little bit of a sense of urgency now here to get this done, I think that the new owner has to come in and dot the I's and cross the T's on that deal. Now, here's what's interesting is the deal has to be in place by September, a lease for that land has to be in place by September of next year. So the clock is ticking on that. I think what's going to happen here is by mid-January, we're going to know who the owner of the Senators will be.
Wow, okay.
It will then take 6 months to paper that deal. But I think at that point, Scott, the new owner can then be involved in the deal to make sure that LeBreton Flats is done. And I think that there's an app. The key to this and the reason I think it will get done is the last deal was for like 50 acres. Or 53 acres. I mean, we were talking about a massive development. This is going to be maybe a hotel and a rink. It's 6 acres of land. It's a very small parcel. I think this will be a much easier deal to get done.
Well, and the questions around here, certainly in Hamilton, even today, as people were learning more about this, was, well, does this mean Michael Andlauer is a local guy? Does this mean he's going to buy the team and move it to Hamilton? And besides all the other hurdles that might be in the way here, it appears anyway, again, from the outside and looking at what's happened for, say, in Arizona, Gary Bettman does not seem like he wants teams moving around. And it would have to be, I mean, look, I was going to say the worst case scenario. I don't know what Arizona is. I mean, it's beyond the worst case scenario. And yeah, yet he doesn't want that team moving. So it doesn't look from the outside like Ottawa is going anywhere. Even in even if that situation were to fall apart again, it just doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere.
No, and you're going to, you know, they're going to sign a long-term lease with the National Capital Commission for that land. So they won't be able to go anywhere. And the other thing is that the land surrounding the Canadian Tire Center is going to be pretty valuable. I mean, it's on a huge parcel of land, and that land alone is going to bring in a lot of money for whoever buys this team. Now,
is that privately owned, Bruce? Is that private land?
Developing that land when they did move downtown, and I think one of the things that they would certainly talk about was a casino and a hotel. Whether that would ever go ahead, I don't know. But, you know, it's been very interesting here because I think I'm fairly certain that sometime in the last few years, and I want to say maybe it was 3 years ago, Michael Andlauer approached Eugene Melnyk about buying the team. And at that point, Eugene Melnyk said, there's no point even discussing it. I'm not going to sell it. So that was kind of the end of the discussion. I think that when the whole first run at LeBreton took place, I think that Andre Desmarais approached Eugene Melnyk about buying the team and spoke with Gary Bettman about it. And at that point, he didn't want to talk about it. So I anticipate that they'll be involved again. The Kimmel family in Toronto approached Eugene in December about being involved in the LeBreton project. At that point, the National Hockey League told Eugene, don't take a partner into LeBreton this time. See if you can do your own bid, get partners who can help you with the whole plan, and then when it comes time to, if you win that, then bring in a partner, because then everybody will know what's involved. So I think what happened was the Melnyk family wasn't going to be able to do this project by themselves. They were going to have to bring in a partner, and I think that this was a very emotional decision for his daughters to put the team up for sale, but I think they feel it's the right thing to do to ensure the long-term sort of the future of this team in the city.
Bruce, you mentioned, and we only have a minute or so left here, you mentioned several days ago, as I say, you, I think, were the first one to mention Michael Andlauer, certainly the first I saw. People in Ottawa reading that piece and trying to figure out who these people were you were talking about, just the ones you mentioned just now, what have been the questions about him? Because he's not a really, really well-known guy. He's very successful in business. He's been in hockey for a long time, but he's kind of flown under the radar in a lot of ways, I think intentionally. What are people asking about him?
Well, I think they want to know what he's all about, and I think it's interesting that anybody you talk to in hockey absolutely adores Michael Andlauer. People you talk to who have worked for him say that he just runs a first-class operation in Hamilton, and they have nothing but good things to say about him. And the thing I keep hearing is that, you know, he wants to take the next step as a National Hockey League owner because he feels like he can have a bigger role in a franchise. And I think people find him very intriguing. And look, we might see some billionaire from the States come in and buy this team. Who knows? But I think I think if you can't have local ownership, I think that Michael Andlauer partnered with some local people here, and in a small part, and Ryan Reynolds would be a nice way to see this franchise go.
Yeah, I mean, Eugene Melnyk, from what we see from the outside, he was a pretty big presence in Ottawa. Michael Andlauer is, again, the same things I said a moment ago. He's a guy who doesn't hog the spotlight. I wonder if a franchise needs a face like a Ryan Reynolds or someone, even if he's only in for 5%, but if he's suddenly the guy that you see, I wonder if that's important.
Oh, I think it is. I think it would be nothing but good for the NHL and for the city to have a guy like Ryan Reynolds involved with whatever turns out happening here. And I also think that anybody who comes in here is going to want to get Daniel Alfonso involved as well. Mm.
Bruce Garriock from the Ottawa Sun. Great work on this already. Really appreciate you taking a few minutes. Thanks for doing this.
Anytime. Take care.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We did see in the election, municipal election a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago almost now, we saw a huge turnover. Already a number of incumbent councillors announced they weren't going to be running. And then we saw a number of others lose. And that has meant that there are many new councillors that are going to be around the table who have not been there before. And, you know, it's fine to say, well, that's fine. They're new. They'll figure out their job on the fly. Well, yes and no. There are some jobs that you come in and you can spend a month or two learning how to do, maybe more. I'm not sure that city council is that. You are going to be having stuff landing on your desk that matters from day one. It's probably best you have some idea what's going on. So city councillors, the new councillors, and maybe the older ones too, I'm not sure, we'll find out in a second, but certainly the new ones for the last couple of days have been going through what I'm calling council boot camp. Jeff Beatty is the incoming councillor for Ward 10. He joins us now. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm very good, Scott. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks for doing this, and congratulations, by the way. That's fantastic for you. Well done.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So is boot camp an appropriate term, or would you go with something else?
Well, I think I overheard earlier you were describing the pig guts and the machine guns rolling on our bellies, and I thought that footage was deleted, but somehow I guess it leaked out.
Yeah. You know, that would be valuable footage, I'm telling you. Down the road somewhere, that would be, and climbing the wall, rope course and everything else, it would be like a scene from Stripes. The early
Why
part
not?
Of Stripes.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, our boot camp was not quite that graphic, but we have been going through a period of orientation, and no peg guts, no machine gun fire, no climbing walls, but intense nonetheless.
Okay, so let's back up for a second. You have been someone who has been involved in municipal politics in the sense you were on a school board. So this is not entirely foreign to you, how meetings work and how the bureaucracy works. This is something you've done before. Nonetheless, when you won, I don't know if you were one of those people who won and then went, holy crap, I just won, or if you were like, no, guaranteed I'm going to win. But when did you start to realize, my goodness, I actually still have an awful lot to learn here?
I think the day after the election, Scott, was that suspended reality where, as you mentioned, like, oh my gosh, what just happened? But the next day, and as you mentioned, I did have some previous experience as an elected official, and it started to feel a little more familiar in terms of the starting line, and off we go. So there was some familiarity. It's been a bit of a mixed bag. I think that having served previously is of value to my position. And I think the majority of the folks around the table have some inkling of what we're getting into. But yeah, there's going to be a bit of a learning curve. We're all on it together. But I'm optimistic that we're going to be able to land it as the thing goes.
So when you go to these meetings, and was it yesterday and today so far?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
And is there more, or was today the second and final day?
Today was the second and final day of what we would call the orientation, but there's going to be a little more training as we go on maybe more refined and specific objectives, but that's all going to be off in the horizon a little bit.
So what do they teach you? First of all, who teaches this?
Well, it's more of familiarizing yourself, and I would say in two respects. I mean, the point is that we get to learn about our colleagues, spend a little time getting to know our council colleagues around the table, but also familiarize ourselves with the senior staff around the administrative level. So your directors, your general managers, familiarizing yourself with different departments, department heads, and getting to know the landscape of who does what, what department looks after what function, and things of that nature from a more operational standpoint. And that's really been the crux of the last 2 days, and including in today, a briefing on what we can expect moving forward into the budgeting process.
When you say you get to know your new council colleagues, that's a really interesting thing. I'm having this vision of the first episode of a series of Survivor where you all land on the island. But, I mean, truthfully, at this point, without naming names, because I know you don't want to create enemies right off the bat or whatever, but can you already see people who are more type A than you thought or not as dominant? Or can you already see personalities coming out? Or is everybody being a little bit quiet and cautious right now?
I don't think that there's any quiet and cautiousness around the table. I think we're all being quite forward, but Scott, I think there's a willingness, I think, to take a step back, not overplay our hand, as it were, and take a moment to understand the perspective of whoever is talking at the moment. We all want this to work, and I think that's a common thread. I can't speak for anybody but myself, but from my observance of what's been going on the last couple of days, I really truly believe that everyone wants this new council to succeed. So we are taking time to be, respectful of each other. We're acknowledging each other's ideas, even though we may have differing opinions in the future. We're really taking the time to lay a good foundation for the next 4 years, I think.
There is, there's a way that meetings work, and some people are very familiar with city council or other executive meetings. Other people, it would be, would be new. Is it obvious that, I mean, you said that most people come in with some idea, but there's a lot of, little things that go on in these meetings and protocols and things like that. Have you had to go over that of how the meetings work and who gets to talk and how you have to second and all that kind of stuff that will go on?
We haven't got into the nuances of that specifically yet. I understand that that'll be forthcoming before we hit our first meeting and it'll be the week after our inauguration. Like I said, I do think that either directly or indirectly, the vast majority of the incoming council has some experience either sitting around a horseshoe of type or through delegating to City Hall and watching from the outside. I think we're all in pretty good shape on the decorum and the process, and I don't really foresee us taking too long on that learning curve.
There is not just learning this stuff, but there is literally and figuratively setting up an office. I mean, you have to have an assistant. You have to, as I say, put an office together in City Hall. Yep. But how much work is involved in doing that?
We're kind of stuck in this nether region, as it were, because we all want to get in there and get going, but we don't have any official standing until after inauguration takes place. So we're moving towards establishing, we're hiring assistants. We're trying to figure out, what will be required in our new offices and when we're going to be able to start moving in and, getting settled. That's a process that's ongoing. We're kind of doing the best that we can whilst still being respectful to those who are, leaving the same space that we want to occupy. So, as I said, it's a little bit of a dance, the lack of a better term. But I think we're gonna land it okay. There's a lot of supports from city staff to help us along the way. Once inauguration hits, I'm pretty confident that we're all going to be, relatively speaking, hitting the ground running.
Do you know in City Hall, I mean, have you even been through, do you know where your office is or which office you're Ward 10. Does Ward 10 have the office or is it a choice of who gets to pick where?
It's my understanding, and I can only speak from my own experience, but it's my understanding that the current ward offices are basically continuing forward. I don't know of other councilor-elect experiences. But I happen to know that, the councilor-elect for Ward 11 is continuing in Ward 11. I happen to be next door in Ward 10. I'm continuing on in that office to the best of my knowledge. That seems to be the process, and it's probably the most fair and easiest way forward, I would suggest, for an incoming council, just to continue in the footprint of the outgoing council.
When it comes time, and this is all part of the, I would think, the learning process here, and you say, you know, learning about senior staff and everything else, mm-hmm. but the people who have ever watched a city council meeting or gone online, the volume of paper at times that will come with a meeting is honestly, it's enormous.
Yes.
How is this something that most of you, certainly yourself, speaking for yourself, is this something you've ever had to deal with before, just to work your way through that amount of stuff in a short period of time?
Well, like we hit off the beginning of the conversation, Scott, having served on the school board in various roles through different committee structures as vice chair of the board, I am used to a certain amount of reports that are going to come through. So I've got a good foundation on that. I imagine that the amount will be incrementally bigger than I'm used to. But it's all a matter of scale. So when you move into a area of larger responsibility, the reports and the amount of information flow is going to be that much bigger. So, as we move forward, I have no doubt that there'll be a lot thrown at me. I think with the expression that we were using today was drinking from a fire hose, just the amount of data that's coming at you. But you learn to adapt, and I'm pretty confident that we're all going to be able to get there. Those who have preloaded experience will probably benefit from it a little more than those that are starting from scratch. But again, we're all eager and willing to get started. I think it's going to be a good 4 years in the long run.
You have, as you've mentioned a couple of times, you've not been sworn in yet. That happens in a couple of weeks.
A week from today.
Okay. That said, how many people have already reached out to you already asking for stuff, even though you're not in a position to do anything right now? Has that already begun?
Oh, yeah. The night of the election, in fact.
Really?
People were starting to. Yeah, it didn't take long.
Like what? What did they ask for the night of the election?
Oh, gosh. The culvert in front of my house needs work. I have an issue with a permit outstanding. The full gamut, Scott. And I think people are realistic in knowing that there's going to be a bit of a lag time for me to be able to get back to them right away. You know, you respond back to the email and say, listen, I appreciate you reaching out right away. I want to help you. Here's the reality of the situation. I'm limited in the capacity that I have right now, but as soon as we can, we're going to move forward. But it's been a mixed bag of literally everything and pretty nearly every day since the 25th of October.
So how many emails a day are you already getting from people?
I'm trying not to count.
That many?
It started off, I think the initial inflow of emails was much higher than it is now. It's a two or three a day for myself right now. Initially, it was substantially higher. Again, I couldn't tell you exactly. It seems to have leveled off, but it's part of the job, and I can't blame people. They want to get their issue kind of in the door. They want to be first in line, as it were. They want to see action on whatever the issue is that's affecting them. And so it's expected as far as I'm concerned. And as soon as I'm able to, I will be responding to everything in an orderly fashion.
This may sound like a weird question, and probably it's the wrong word, but...
Oh, good.
Well, no, but one of the things that we always hear about is that people will call. You just talked about the culvert. I want something done, and I want it done right now. Have you yet figured out, and again, forgive the word, but have you yet figured out how much power you have or don't have?
No, I guess I haven't. I'm coming at this from the lens, as I keep going back to the lens that I had as a trustee, it's a process of taking in the concern from the constituent, then working with the appropriate department or staff member to understand the situation and then bring forward a response back to the constituent. I don't know exactly what those timelines are going to look like. I don't know how fast they're going to happen quite yet. And I don't know what kind of direct input that the counselor would have into that particular situation. I would imagine that it would vary on the particular inquiry. You know, if somebody has an issue that they want a brand new park built tomorrow, that's probably not going to happen right away. A culvert issue, there may be a little more of a, you know, a quick response. But those are going to be some things that there'll be some learning on the go as we move forward.
But that's kind of what I was just asking, though. And you're getting to the point, but it's let's say with the culvert, someone says, I have this problem, I want it done. Have you yet, do you know, or was this part of what the boot camp has been to say, someone asks you for this, who can you go to? Do you go to the head of the department? Do you just go down to the office? Do you, like, what are you, as a counselor, do you know yet what you're able to do directly? Or is there a whole process that you're still navigating?
The process is still being navigated. I'm going to be leaning a little bit on the administrative assistant that I've hired to work in the office. The individual that I've hired has comes kind of preloaded with an understanding of how the system works, probably a little better than myself. She's going to be able to help me navigate through that to understand, we're going to call this person and we're going to wait for a response from this department or whatever the issue is. Having somebody with some on-the-ground experience within the inner workings of City Hall is going to be a benefit to me and the constituents who attend as I learn what those roles are going to look like.
There is one other thing here that is probably a tricky part of this, and that is you and a number of the other new councillors, for sure, some of the older ones too, the incumbents too, but mm-hmm. you have other careers. You had jobs. You have a business. What do you do with that business?
Well, I'm fortunate, Scott, insofar as my business partner is my wife. She is an experienced manager, and she's going to continue on managing the business. My input will still be there in terms of running the business, but it will be lessened. So, you know, again, I'm in a fortunate position. Each individual member of the incoming council is going to have their own experience as to how they depart from a former career or, you know, whatever the case will be. As I said, I'm in good shape and looking forward to the future on that one.
Do you have time? I mean, honestly, when it comes time to say, I'd love to help out. Or is this a great out for you? I'm sorry. I can't do it today. I'm sorry. I got a meeting. I'm out of here. On your own.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically going to be that, I've got I say 9 to 5, but it's going to extend well beyond that. It's going to be a 9 to 9 or whatever the terms are going to be. I think that people will be more likely to see me around my business on the weekends. They're probably not going to see a whole lot of me during the week, but whenever I'm able to, and if the workload permits, I'll be able to come and participate in some fashion. But my day-to-day managing of my business is going to be very, very limited to what I've just described there.
Last thing then, is there such a thing when you're a city councilor in your mind, in Jeff Beattie's mind at this point, before you've even been sworn in, is there a time when it's not cool to be talking about council stuff when you are off? Or once you're a councillor, is that a 24-hour-a-day thing? So if you're at the business and someone comes up and wants to talk about their culvert, that's okay?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have no illusions that people won't try to approach you in the grocery store or try to bring up an issue at my business or wherever they see me. And in fact, that's already been the reality. People have already popped into my business or bumped into me at Costco or wherever and expressed that, gosh, we got to work on this or we have to do that. I think that's part of the role. How I manage that will be depending on the situation. I would say that I welcome it. I understand it's part of the position that I've asked for. And, if people bump into me in the store, I'm going to do the best that I can. Probably it will be taking information and sending it into my office so that I can process it from a desk somewhere and determine best next steps. But there's no I don't think there's any real time off, in quotes, unless I decide that I'm taking a vacation and taking the kids up north or something like that.
Well, you chuckled when we used the example of the first episode of Survivor. Have you figured out who's in the alliance yet or who's going to be voted off first?
I don't think they've handed out the buffs yet.
Yeah, good answer. Good answer.
It remains to be seen, Scott. Like I said, I had the good fortune to meet with everyone now. I mean, every member of the existing and outgoing council, the returning champions, as it were, to use that same Survivor theme, except for Councillor Pauls. I'll put that on my list and I'll make sure that I get a chance to connect with her. And we are, even though we may be wearing, different buffs, as it were, I think we're still going to be working together. I really am feeling optimistic about the future for the next 4 years.
That'll be good. Just make sure you learn how to make fire. That's all.
Well, it's the foundation of everything. There you go.
Jeff Beatty, incoming counselor for Ward 10. Really appreciate the time today. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much, Scott. Great talking with you.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode, and also be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.